Hey, have you ever noticed that Jews and Muslims don't get along? There seems to be this problem, and it's been going on for quite some time. But the problem was greatly aggravated, it seems, just about a decade and a half ago, as the muezzin began to issue the haunting call to prayer in the morning of October the 8th, 1990. Some 3,000 of the faithful gathered in front of the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Haram es Sharif, Jerusalem's famed Temple Mount. In fact, the Al-Aqsa Mosque was originally built not as a mosque, but as a Christian church. And at the conquest of Islam in Jerusalem, which was then a Christian city, Jerusalem's greatest Christian sites were converted into mosques. And so that's how the Al-Aqsa Mosque wound up becoming a mosque. But as the call to prayer went out that morning, instead of quietly making their way into the mosque, the Ummah, true believers, began to stockpile huge quantities of rocks and bricks and bottles, scraps of iron and other makeshift weapons. Now, if you've ever seen a picture of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock and the whole Temple Mount area, there's this long wall that was recovered by British archaeologists about a century and a half ago. Long wall that was one of the foundation walls of Herod's temple. And that long wall, the only remaining portion of the old temple, is now what we call the Wailing Wall. And it's directly below. It's like this long retainer wall. Up on the top is the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. And directly below is the holiest place in all of worldwide Judaism. And a place that was gloriously recovered for the Jewish people following the Six-Day War in 1967. So 40 feet below where these weapons are being gathered during the call to prayer, there are some 20,000 Jewish pilgrims and tourists entirely oblivious to the disaster brewing up on the mount. They were celebrating Sukkot at the Wailing Wall. All of a sudden, cries of Allah Akbar, Allah is great, Jihad, Holy War, Ikbak al Yahal, slaughter the Jews, began to erupt over the mosque's loudspeaker. And at that moment, a well-orchestrated assault began. Stockpiled weapons were hurled down upon the heads of the Jewish worshippers. They're down there bowing and praying at the Wailing Wall. 40 feet above them is this horde of very angry East Jerusalem Muslims, and they are throwing broken glass and rocks and bricks down 40 feet onto the heads of the Jewish worshippers, the pilgrims, and the tourists. A small police outpost on the mount was burned to the ground. Huge boulders were rolled across nearby intersections to prevent police reinforcements from entering the area. And an unruly mob of teenagers began ransacking the shops and stores in adjacent neighborhoods. The melee lasted for nearly an hour. About 40 Israeli policemen tried to disperse the rioters with tear gas and rubber bullets, but to no avail. The enraged Muslims fought back with axes and chains. Rocks continued to rain down from the mount. The streets of the old city were rife with rioters. finally, the police resorted to live ammo. And when the dust was cleared, some 21 Muslims lay dead. And the crisis in the Middle East had just escalated out of control. This was the beginning of the last intifada, which is an Arabic word that means uprising, but it's a peculiar kind of uprising. It's a rebellion that is rooted in a holy deliverance of occupied land. It is the prelude to jihad, holy war. Another cheerless chapter was about to be written in the eternal blood feud between Ishmael and Isaac, one that would unleash a rash of suicide bombings and terror spilling out from Israel and Palestine into the entire world in successive waves of intifada. And thus, the modern holy war of Islam was launched. We've only come to know just in recent months that the first intifada was actually well-funded and well-planned by a small Saudi terrorist cell group known as Al-Qaeda. And the purpose of this intifada was, according to captured documents in Afghanistan, it was to finally reveal to the world the satanic conspiracy of the United States and Great Britain against the oppressed peoples of the world in maintaining what the documents call the perverse rape of the global disenfranchised by the insidious specter of global Jewry. There is bad blood between Muslims and Jews. And that bad blood goes all the way back, as I alluded to last night, to Ishmael and Isaac. Let's rehearse once again a bit of this history and focus in on it a bit more. Israel is the promised land of the Jews, according to Genesis 12:7. It is their Abrahamic inheritance, according to Genesis chapter 15, verses 18 through 21. But one of the things that we have to recognize historically is that the Jews, throughout history, have only inhabited it rarely. When Moses secured freedom from slavery in Egypt for his people, he led them back to that patriarchal homeland. They had been absent for about 400 years. During that time, others inhabited the region. In fact, those others had inhabited the region prior to that 400 years, back to time immemorial, before Abram ever left Ur of the Chaldees. The Canaanites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Midianites, and all of the other ites in the Bible dwelled in that land. They made their homes in and around Palestine, and they were hardly inclined to recognize Israel's tentative prior claim. In addition, the original settlers, the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Girgasites, the Zamzumim, the Zumim, the Jebusites, they were equally uncooperative. War between Ishmael and Isaac was inevitable. According to the Bible, the conquest of the land under the leadership of heroes of faith and valor like Joshua and Caleb and Othniel and Ehud and Shamgar and Deborah and Gideon and Jephthah and Samson and Samuel and Saul and David was long and bloody and a torturous affair not to be forgotten by either side ever. The Sahih Muslim Annals, written during the time of Muhammad Hirjah in Medina, assert this: the criminal Jews have brought destruction destruction upon the Ummah since the earliest times. Their leaders conspired to send the innocent of Canaan away from their homes. They repulsed the pleas of Philistine widows and Moabite orphans and washed their fields in the blood of Ammonite poor. Therefore they shall not stand in the day of judgment, nor shall they prevail against the sure coming of jihad. Allah shall pronounce just retribution, and the Ummah shall observe with joy and gladness their utter destruction. Every Jew must be wiped clean from Allah's earth. I don't know about you, but I don't see a lot of wiggle room in that for negotiation. Now, as a result, I read you a couple of rather incendiary quotes. Let me read you a couple more from the same sources that I was alluding to last night. Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, several years before he signed the extraordinary Camp David Accord with Israel, said this: "The assassination of Arab brethren like Goliath by Jewish sheepherders like David is the sort of shameful enemy that we must yet set aright in the domain of the occupied Palestinian homeland." He's still hacked off about this. It happened a while ago, but he hasn't forgotten. At about the same time, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat declared, "Be assured that the many indignities heaped upon the Palestinian people since ancient times must and shall be avenged. Israel's policy in the occupied territories is little more than an extension of the imperialist tactics of the conqueror Joshua." Ever think of Joshua as an imperialist before? "Surely the judgment of Allah is reserved for them until Palestine is transformed from Dal al-Harb, the land of the world, to Dar al-Islam, the land of Islam. Ishmael shall have his revenge." End quote. One of the astonishing things is if you read much contemporary Islamic literature, particularly the political rhetoric of revolutionaries like Osama bin Laden, is that it's like topsy-turvy world. I mean, all of the stories in the Bible that you think you know, they turn them upside down so that the bad guys are good guys. I never thought about Jezebel as some poor, oppressed, misunderstood woman. Somehow, I never thought of Elijah as a bigoted, politically incorrect slob. But this is the topsy-turvy world that Islam lives in, and they live in it constantly. Following the demise of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah at the hands of the Assyrians and the Babylonians, it seems that Ishmael had finally had his revenge. But then the Persians restored Isaac to Palestine, and the ancient rivalry was resumed, beginning with Tobiah and Sanballat's challenge of Ezra and Nehemiah. The advent of Greek and Roman imperial rule quelled the fires of hatred for a short time. Stability was forcibly imposed upon the Middle East by the legions of the West, until the Roman armies laid waste to Palestine, crushing the aspirations of both Ishmael and Isaac, and suddenly we're back to square one. Most of the Jews who survived the destruction of Jerusalem and the devastation of the land at the hands of the Romans joined the already very large diaspora in exile. And there, they influenced various aspects of Western life, such as the medical guild on the island of Chios, where they helped to forge the Hippocratic Oath, or the academic schools of the philosophers in Athens, where they shaped the ethics and the metaphysics of such people, quoting oftentimes verbatim from Moses, people like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. But a few of the Jews remained behind. These determined Jewish pioneers attempted to scratch out a living in the blighted environs of Palestine. During the period of Roman and later Byzantine rule, Palestine was sorely neglected. Its poverty became abject. Once very lush gardens and fertile fields were left to the scourge of harsh elements. Trees and vegetation were cut away with profligate indulgence. What remained of the once beautiful architecture deteriorated badly due to neglect. Even so, the Jews were legally protected in this now Christian land and could work and worship in relative peace and security. The Arab population, the sons of Ishmael, by this time had largely converted to Christianity, and Palestine simply became a tiny Jewish island in the vast sea of the Christian Middle East. I love, when I'm in the Middle East, to visit the old Byzantine churches of the patristic age, in the years of the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th centuries. Some amazing buildings were built and some amazing communities were established. And a thriving Christian culture grew up in that land. We often forget that the entire Middle East and all of North Africa was the heart and soul of the Christian church in those days. It was the Middle East and North Africa that produced the greatest thinkers, the greatest apologists, the greatest heroes, the founders of Western civilization came from the Middle East, from North Africa. Athanasius, St. Augustine, Jerome, these were people who lived and worked in this realm. And so the Jews were once again a distinct minority in a land that was filled with Christians. But then came Islam. During the time that he was exiled from Mecca, Muhammad launched a fierce jihad, his first jihad, against the significant Jewish diaspora communities of the Hejaz. The Jews, scattered now, off into the Greek and Roman worlds, far afield in Europe and throughout the Middle East, were no longer in the squalor of Palestine. Rather, they were finding ways to make lives and careers and even large fortunes around the globe. In Medina, the interim headquarters of his nascent movement, Muhammad had all of the Jewish men scourged and maimed in the public square. It was the tactic of conversion in those days for Muhammad to have first the right hand and then the left foot and then the left hand and then the right foot removed for infidelity. And so people would have a long and tortured opportunity to convert. Oftentimes, with the very soft vision of the Byzantines, softened by successive waves of heresies, the Nestorian heresy, but the Monophysite heresy, and so on. They quickly converted after a hand or a foot or two. But the Jews remained recalcitrant. They held on to their tradition. And so he had them decapitated or disemboweled in the public square. He then divided their women, children, animals, and property among his followers. And in that manner, within a few months, he wiped out the entire Jewish population of Medina. During this time, he recorded in his Quranic revelations the immutability of the eternal conflict between Muslims and Jews. This is what that great spiritual book of peace, the Quran, says about the Jews. In Surah chapter 5, verse 82, "You shall surely find the most violent of all men in enmity against the Ummah to be the Jews." Surah chapter 5, verse 51. "O true believers, take not the Jews and the Christians for your friends. They cannot be trusted. They are defiled. They are filth, particularly the Jews." Surah chapter 2, verse 61. "The Jews are smitten with vileness and misery and drew on themselves indignation from Allah." Surah 3, 112. "Wherever they are found, the Jews reek of destruction, which is their just reward." One of the things that the Nazis picked up from their Turkish allies during successive conflicts that ultimately culminated in World War II were certain caricatures of the Jewish people. The fact that the Jewish people were vermin, the fact that the Jewish people smelled, the fact that Jewish people were greedy. The Nazis didn't make this stuff up. In fact, Hitler was a notorious borrower. There was virtually nothing original in his thinking or his writing. All of those caricatures come directly out of Muslim writings, from the Quran to the Meccan Chronicles. In the Sahih Muslim Annals, all Jews were anathema and were to be annihilated. "Now Allah's messenger, may peace be upon him, has commanded, fight against the Jews and kill them. Pursue them until even a stone would say, come here, Muslim, quickly. There's a Jew hiding himself behind me. Kill him quickly." Now that's a twist on "the rocks and stones shall cry out." For the first time in centuries, the old feud between Ishmael and Isaac had been revived. If he gained more and more control over the Arabian Peninsula and then over the entire Mediterranean world, Muhammad tempered his policy of wholesale slaughter. And there was a very practical reason for this. Wherever he went, wherever his caliphs went, wherever all of his successors in various Muslim armies went, they discovered that that the Jews had skills and money and influence and could thus prove to be useful in the process of governing these vast new territories. Many of the hated Jews proved to be valuable assets in his administration. Some had professional skills and resources. Others had economic skills and resources. Thus, he and his successors found it politic to invent a kind of treaty in which to accommodate both the hatred of the Jews and the need for the Jews. This new treaty was something called the Dehima. The Dehima was a device used to not merely subjugate his beaten foes, but to find a way to use them in the midst of their new servile status, sparing their lives in exchange for a tithe of one half of all of their wealth and all of their property to be levied in perpetuity. Jews, and then later Christians, were thus spared as long as they continued to contribute to the ongoing support of jihad with the substance of their wealth. Under the Turks in later years, this tithe included not just a tithe of one half of all income and one half of all wealth, but one half of all children, which is where they recruited the Janissaries, the assassins, to be raised by the Muslims to fight in the front lines, the Republican Guard, so to speak, of the Islamic conquest. Over time, even Dehima became more sophisticated. The subject peoples were given the right to live and to practice their religion on a limited basis, in private, in the privacy of their own homes, as long as they didn't talk about it, and as long as they weren't offensively attempting to proselytize for it. This is becoming interestingly like the federal government, isn't it? About half your income and half of your kids, and you can have your religion as long as you don't talk about it and try and pretend that anything is under God or anything. Ultimately, the subject peoples were given the right to exercise these privileges and even receive some level of protection, a constitutional right, in return for the payment of special taxes. The kaharaj, or land tax, the jizya, or the poll tax, the fadlak, or the travel tax, the sulta, or the special taxes levied at the ruler's pleasure. The problem was that the status of the captive people was always at risk, since the dehima merely suspended the conqueror's Quranic right to kill them and confiscate the property. Thus, it could be revoked at the slightest whim, at any time. When Muhammad died in 632, the scourge of jihad and dehima had only just begun. Over the next decade, Muhammad's successors, first Caliph Abu Bakr and then Caliph Umar, were able to consolidate their military control over all of Arabia, from the Hejaz to Naqid, from Asir to Hasa. They captured and conquered most of what is today Iraq and Byzantine Egypt. They made serious advances against Syria that permanently destabilized that Christian province. And by 638, they'd conquered Palestine as well. Thousands of Jews were slaughtered, along with the Byzantine Christians. A few of the most technically proficient Jews continued to live under the Muslim domination of dehima. In fact, Baghdad and portions of Syria and the cities of Damascus and Granada in Spain all boasted strong Jewish professional communities, but most of the rest fled into uneasy exile in Christian Europe. In any case, Palestine was emptied of its indigenous population once again, and the conflict between Ishmael and Isaac was made moot again, but only for a little while. Palestine is a pretty desolate place. If you've ever had the opportunity to take a bus ride through what is called the wilderness of Judah, where Jesus went for his fast, you know that the road from Jericho up to Bethany and then down into Jerusalem is a very alien place. It's like the dark side of the moon. You can go for miles and see no vegetation whatsoever, just these giant boulders. It's an inhospitable place, and while the plains down from the Judean hills and toward the sea are quite fertile. They are fertile only with a massive amount of irrigation. And so during the time from the middle of the 7th century onward, almost to modern times, the region was essentially abandoned. Nobody lived there. It's really interesting to hear claims of Palestinian families that talk about long-held land holdings in Palestine, because we have first-hand accounts in the 1830s and 40s and 50s of people entering into the land and walking for miles, dozens of miles, without ever seeing another human being. The region was just completely depopulated. It was empty and devoid. There are a few little villages, pockets here and there, but most of the people who are now Palestinians really come from other places. Yasser Arafat, for instance, is a Kuwaiti, not a Palestinian. And so this conflict between Ishmael and Isaac seems to dissipate until Zionism was born in the 19th century. Zionism was born in Europe among well-educated Jewish professionals who had finally come to realize that absorption into Western Christian culture was utterly impossible. It seemed to them that the path to acceptance was hopelessly blocked either by prejudice or avarice or perhaps even worldview and catabolism. Within months, he transformed what had been little more than wishful thinking for centuries into a fierce revolutionary political movement. His book, Der Judenstaat, became the lightning rod for two generations of Jews who had struggled, fought, bled, and died to realize their ambition of independence from the West. Inspired by Herzl's vision and supported by a worldwide network of Zionist organizations, Jewish families began a return to Palestine, buying up small tracts of barren deserts and abandoned ruins from the doddering Ottoman overseers. After World War I, when the British assumed responsibility for the administration of the region, first a small trickle, and finally a steady stream of Jewish settlers made their way out of the lands of persecution back to Zion. After World War II, the horrors of the Holocaust were revealed to the world, and a literal flood of exiles returned from the diaspora. For the first time in centuries, Ishmael and Isaac lived in proximity to one another, and then, not surprisingly, tensions began to flare. The British, bless their hearts, desperately tried to appease both sides. Always a bad idea when you're dealing with Ishmael and Isaac. The Balfour Declaration in 1917 committed the government to supporting the Zionist cause, but also supporting the cause of the indigenous Arabs. And so the British, between World War I and World War II, essentially and very effectively waffled, wiggled, and wavered. They played the political game, a bitter cycle of demonstrations and strikes and riots and terrorism and reprisals followed on both sides of the conflict for more than three decades. In frustration, the British, together with the newly constituted United Nations, decided to draw a line of partition through the District of Palestine. What they decided to do was try and create two separate states. They created a Palestinian state. It was the region known as Transjordan and ultimately became the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. That was the Palestinian state. And then there was the Jewish state, which became known as Israel. All of the British good intentions, all of the United Nations good intentions ultimately came to naught because, of course, even the road to hell is paved with good intentions. The day after Israel officially became a nation, May 14, 1948, three Palestinian Arab armies, the Nahada forces, the Arab Liberation Army, and the Futuwah Defense League, along with the national military forces of Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, and several contingents from the Saudi Arabian army, launched a bitter war for control of the entire Palestinian region. Now, this time, the Israelis didn't have jet fighters. At this time, the Israelis didn't have anything. At this time, all they had was a tiny population and a fierce desire to hold on to their secular nationalist dream. According to the Arab leaders, there was absolutely no possibility for any sort of compromise or negotiated peace, and there was no question that the massed armies of the Middle East would succeed. against the tiny, hardscrabble forces of the Jews newly escaped from concentration camps in Central Europe. Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem who had served the Nazis during World War II and who now led the Palestinian Arab resistance, declared this: "The entire Jewish population in Palestine must be destroyed or driven into the sea." Basically, same difference. "Allah has bestowed upon us the rare privilege of finishing what Hitler only began. Let the jihad begin. Murder the Jews. Murder them all." King Abdul Aziz ibn Saud, the founding member of the Saudi Sultanate and the first king of Saudi Arabia, said, "The Arab nations should sacrifice up to 10 million of their 50 million people if necessary to wipe out the tens of thousands of Israel. Israel to the Arab world is like a cancer to the human body, and the only way of remedy is to uproot it." Likewise, his brother Al-Riyad Saud said, "The power struggle between Israel and the Arabs is a long-term historical trial. Victory or defeat are for us questions of existence or annihilation, the outcome of an irreconcilable hatred." Azam Pasha, Secretary General of the Arab League, asserted that this will be a war of extermination and a momentous massacre which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres and the Crusades. No Jew will be left alive. Ouch. King Farouk of Egypt concurred. "The Jews in Palestine must be exterminated. There can be no other option for those of us who revere the name of Allah. There will be no dehima. There will only be jihad." From King Abdullah of Transjordan to Zahir Shah of Afghanistan, from Imam Yahya of Yemen to King Hassan of Morocco, from Reza Shah of Iran to Regent Abd al-Ilah of Iraq, every Muslim leader in the Middle East called for the destruction of Israel and the execution of the Jews. Even the moderate King Idris of Libya sounded the call for genocide. He said, and this is the most moderate guy in the region, "The Zionist conquest of Palestine is an affront to all Muslims. This colonialist barbarism cannot and will not be tolerated. There can be no compromise until every Jew is dead and gone." And I have to remember, Israel's been a nation now for a couple of days, just a few hours. They have no army, they have no infrastructure, they have no police force. They really have almost nothing. A few of the Jewish commandos that the British hired during World War II had remnants of their weaponry from that conflict, which they had squirreled away for just such a day as this. But that was about it. The war, amazingly, ended in a stalemate. Somehow the Jews, making jeeps out of cardboard, literally, fought their way to a stalemate, held their ground against massively superior forces. Israel kept most of the territory that it was allotted during the partition, plus a little bit more. But the animosity between Ishmael and Isaac only intensified. Successive wars, bringing the full wrath of all of the Arab nations upon tiny little Israel in 1956, 1967, and 1973, made their conflict a global concern. In addition, the terrorist strikes of the Palestine Liberation Organization and the involvement of Israel in the Lebanese Civil War only aggravated the open wounds of dispossession, anarchy, and geopolitical strife. Violence became a regular part of the Palestinian landscape, as familiar as the Judean hills. I've been to Israel more than 20 times. I've taken tour groups, great big honking buses filled with fat Americans, to all of the sites throughout the Middle East. And one of the things that I always prepare my tours for are the ordinary difficulties of traveling in a war-torn land. I've never been to Israel where I haven't at one time or another had to warn people to pull their handkerchiefs out of their pockets and put them over their nose and mouth because a wave of tear gas is blowing in with the wind. You go to Israel and there are blockades. There are soldiers with machine guns everywhere around all the time. You walk through the big Jerusalem Mall, walk past Burger King, and what's standing there at Burger King? 4 or 5 of the Israeli Defense Forces standing guard lest someone blow you up while eating a hamburger. Not a cheeseburger, because of course that's not kosher. And that has become a way of life. One time I was walking alone during the Gulf War up on the top of the Mount of Olives, where the villages of Bethany and Bethsaida are, and I was walking along this little bitty narrow street trying to find a little inn that I'd read about in a 19th century chronicle of British and Viennese travelers to the region, and I thought I might sit down and have a little of that Arabic tea that basically peels 5 layers of skin off of your face and causes you to lose your hair. And I was walking along this street, and all of a sudden I hear a clamor up in front of me, and I look up, and here come the Israeli Defense Forces. And they've got their plexiglass shields, and they're ready to go whoop up on somebody. And I was the only one on the street, so I'm starting to get a little nervous. Until I realized that I was not the only one on the street. I looked behind me, and all of a sudden there was a slew of Palestinian teenagers and women and a handful of old men, and they're all standing there with rocks in their hands doing this number. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm in the middle. I'm thinking to myself, I'd like to not be in the middle. But there is nowhere to go. It's a little bitty donkey track, and there are walls all around me. And all of a sudden I start hearing shouting, first in Arabic and then in Hebrew and then in Arabic and then in Babel. And I'm starting to get genuinely nervous. All of a sudden a hand from a little garden gate reaches out, grabs hold of me, yanks me into this garden, and peering through the slats of the garden gate, I get to watch a riot. Little Palestinian boy dragged me into his family garden, and he several times during the time that we were standing there asked me to give him a little boost up over the wall so that he could throw a rock too. I'm thinking to myself, if the Israelis see rocks coming over this wall, my safety has suddenly been compromised once again. But standing there on that street, looking through the slats of this little garden, I caught a glimpse of something that has been a life for these people. Not just in 1 or 2 or 3 generations, not just over the course of 1 or 2 or 3 administrations, not just during the course of 1 or 2 or 3 dictators in Iraq or in Iran, but over the course of 1 or 2 or 3 millennia. It was interesting communicating with my little friend who had saved my life, because he was so sweet and dear, and he did save my life perhaps. but the venom that poured forth from him, the hatred of the Jews, woven into the fiber of his being, he was suckled on that hatred. He was nurtured by it. Sheikh Tamimi, the last Mufti of Jerusalem who was responsible for organizing the ill-fated Temple Mount uprising, issued a call for all Muslims to join arms against Israel at a time when it seemed that the Gulf War and its international coalition arrayed against Iraq might permanently disrupt Islamic unity. He said, "The Jews are destined to be persecuted, humiliated, and tortured forever, and it is a Muslim duty to see to it that they reap their due. No petty arguments must be allowed to divide us. Where Hitler failed, we must succeed." Yasser Arafat, chairman of the PLO, mastermind behind the Intifada uprising, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, in the 90s and once again in recent days, has said again and again the same thing. This is what he said: "Our objective is simply the liberation of the Palestinian soil and the establishment of a Palestinian state over every part of it. Thus, the Jews must be removed and Israel must be annihilated. We can accept nothing less." Hafez al-Assad, last dictator of Syria, father of the present dictator of Syria, he agreed. He said, "We shall never call for, nor shall we accept peace. We shall only accept war. We have resolved to drench the land with Israel's blood, to oust the Jews as aggressors, and throw all into the sea." In the face of this animosity, a number of Israeli leaders have responded in kind by authorizing new settlements in the occupied territories, one from Jordan, Syria, and Egypt in the 67 Six-Day War, limiting the movement and civil liberties of Palestinian Arabs, and inhibiting economic opportunities for minority populations. In towns like Bethlehem, the economy has been devastated. It's a Christian town. The Arabs who are there are Christians. Many of them are Israeli citizens. But they're cordoned off, and through the policies of people like Ariel Sharon, they are stigmatized throughout the whole land of Israel. As a result of this intractable conflict, every problem in the Middle East is now somehow connected to the Palestinian question. For instance, when Saddam Hussein overran Kuwait in 1990, he blamed the conflict on Israel. When Hafez al-Assad completed his conquest of Lebanon later that same year, he blamed the crisis on Israel. When Muammar Gaddafi of Libya sparked a coup in Chad, also in 1990, he blamed the situation on Israel. When the Sudanese launched an unholy jihad on the Christian rebels of the south, Farouk Abad, the leader of the Sudanese government coalition, blamed the crisis on Israel. When Khalid al-Hazani launched a pogrom against the refugee camp all along the border of Rwanda, he blamed the crisis on Israel. When Osama bin Laden unleashed his reign of terror on the innocent civilians of the United States in New York City, workers in the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., airline passengers taking off from Boston, he justified his actions by laying the blame squarely at the door of Israel. This seemingly absurd linkage had become inescapable. As Hashemi Rafsanjani of Iran explained, "Every problem in our region can be traced to this single dilemma. The occupation of Dar al-Islam by Jewish infidels or Western imperialists. Every political controversy, every boundary dispute, every internal conflict is spawned by the inability of the Ummah to faithfully and successfully wage jihad. The everlasting struggle between Ishmael and Isaac cannot cease until one or the other is utterly vanquished. And so the conflict continues. And the blood of Abraham continues to be spilled with prodigal abandon. So what do we do with this? How do we respond to this? Conflict between Jews and Muslims is not a question of borders or settlements or of political self-determination. But the Palestinians want a homeland, and that's what the real question is. They already got it. They got it in 1948 with the establishment of Transjordan. Palestinians don't want a homeland. Palestinians want the extermination of the Jews. Can't be solved by manipulating the political apparatus. It is an intractable spiritual problem, and it must therefore be dealt with in spiritual terms. So we walk in the flesh. We do not war according to the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. I've worked for years in ministry with men and women caught in the lifestyle and the culture of homosexuality. In the earlier talk, we heard once again a testimony of the alien worldview that captures people's lives and ultimately their whole being. How the natural tendency of rebellion and sin is to take pride in our very shame. Almost every story of another soul being dragged into homosexuality begins the same way. Hunger, alienation, rejection, capped by a horrific rape. That's been Islam's pattern. Nations are dragged into Islam in the same way that men and women are dragged into sexual aberration. In fact, the terrifying thing is that your pet sin, your protected rebellion, that may be hidden away and nestled aside, has functioned in the same way in your life. And all of these barriers to truth, to beauty, and to goodness can only be overcome by the truth and the beauty and the goodness of the gospel. You know what the Jews desperately need? It's not just another $1 billion of military aid, though to be sure, there are times when we have to fight those who will drag the innocent off into captivity. But what they really need is the gospel. And the Muslims? What is it that has turned Saddam Hussein into the Grinch who stole the world? It's not just that his shoes are three sizes too small. He desperately needs the gospel. If we see the crisis in the Middle East in political terms, military terms, economic terms, and constantly exclude the most important aspect, we will never have a solution. If this problem seems absolutely intractable, it is simply because we constantly view it in these materialist terms. We need to have the heart of J. Hudson Taylor when we look at the problems of the Middle East. One of the great southern agrarians, Andrew Nelson Lytle, once said, "In one sense, Babylon is the acceptance of matter as the only meaning, the source of mystery. That man should accept the shell for the total meaning, that his vanity could lead him a probing into and enabling him to control matter and hence life, is the ultimate folly. It is the perennial sickness of sin. It is the great conflict of Ishmael over Isaac. It's the war. And God calls us to put on full armor, take up appropriate weapons, and go to war, to go to war aright. God, give us the courage to go to war aright. Let's pray. Father, as we break for lunch, I pray that you would enable us to not only ruminate over our sandwiches, but enable us to ruminate over the eternal truths of the gospel and see the entire world and the conflicts of the world in terms of the gospel rather than in mere material Babylonish terms. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.